So I want to welcome everybody this evening who have come from near and far on New Year's Eve. It's a good place to be. Get out of the way of all the New Year's revelers and come and enjoy maybe a bit of a toned down New Year's Eve experience. This is the third in a daily string of Dhamma teachings, Dhamma reflections, Dhamma evenings. We had Saturday night as our usual Saturday night event with a talk, and then last night was the Lunar Observance Day, so we had another reflection. And then every year on New Year's Eve, we do the same thing and have a vigil till midnight to bring in the new year with some paritta, auspicious chanting. And then actually tomorrow we'll be having our traditional New Year's alms round here at the monastery, followed by a bit of a Dhamma reflection as well. So get 4 days in a row, which is pretty unique experience here. Glad we have several monastics to share the fun with this. So this is the third in the series, and past couple of nights, Ajahn Janako and Ajahn Kachana have reflected a bit on the new year to come and how often we make some sort of resolutions, New Year's resolutions, or aditanas, as we call them. Aditana, the Pali word meaning like a determination, something that we want to improve or develop or let go of, habits, as a way of kind of setting a goal, setting a standard, and putting forth some extra energy in a particular area. Going along with the traditional idea of New Year's resolutions. Something else that was occurring to me is that oftentimes it's a good time to also reflect over the past year or longer and see what's rumbling around in there and discontents, difficulties, bad memories or regrets that are looming up, that sometimes come up from past interactions, past actions that we've done, sometimes from very far back, possibly. These things often will come up and remind us that we maybe haven't fully, completely dealt with them. And so the memories come back to us, disturb us, and we either deal with them or we don't deal with them. And if we don't, then they go away for a little while and then come back again. Regrets. And that the end of the year, this December 31st, the last day of 2018, might be also a time tonight or tomorrow or as the new year comes to reflect and to try and understand and reconcile and let go of some of these past actions that we're feeling the effects of. There's a really lovely and I think very, very informative teaching from the Buddha that was very useful to me many years ago, my third Vasa, when I went to Chithurst Monastery in England to have a year away from Abhayagiri and to experience the teachings of another very good teacher, Ajahn Suchito, who was the abbot at that time. We do that in our third Vasa third year as monastics, we have the opportunity to go away for a year. And I chose Chithurst. And it seemed to coincide with a time when stuff was coming up from the past that I felt regret over and that was coming up as challenging memories. Unskillful actions, unskillful behaviors that were weighing heavily on me before, things that happened before I took ordination in my younger adult life, middle adult life. And they just kept coming up, and I couldn't figure out really how to deal with them, regrets, memories. And I was talking about it to some extent with another monk who knew of this teaching that he referred me to, a sutta from the Sanyutta Nikaya called the conch blower. And it's a story or a sutta teaching where one of the disciples of the Nigantas, the Jains, came and talked with the Buddha. He was a village headman, and he was a student of the leader of the Jains, the Nigantha Nataputta. And he was talking with the Buddha about some of the teachings of his teacher, particularly around karma. And the Buddha was asking him how his teacher presented that. And after some discussion, the Buddha, ferreted out that, and described. He said, some of the teachings, and there were a wide variety of teachings around karma or the teachings of, is there the result of action? Are there results? Do actions have results? Ajahn Kachana talked about that a little bit last night as well, but one of the teachings that was common and that the Buddha was reflecting on is that he was saying, suppose a teacher says that anyone at all who commits the breaking the precept of taking the life of any creature, suppose anyone at all takes life, and as a result of that, the teacher says, as a result of taking of life, you will surely be reborn in a lower realm, in a lower destination, even a hell realm. And the student says to himself, well, my teacher says that if I take the life of any living creature, then I'll be born in a lower realm, a hell realm. And I have done that. I have taken life. As a result, I will reach that destination. And the same goes through the other precepts, the precept of taking that which is not given, stealing, sexual misconduct, and also lying, the four basic moral precepts, I have done those kinds of things throughout my life, and my teacher says, as a result, I will be reborn in a lower realm. So the Buddha says, well, yes, if that person then takes that view, believes it, holds to that view, then the result will be indeed what that teacher had said. He will be carried off and dropped off into the lower realms as a result of that action and the holding of the view that that's what the result will be. So long as he does not give up that view, that will be the result of that action. And then he says, well, suppose another teacher comes along, and then he's actually referring to himself, the Buddha, the Tathagata. Suppose a Tathagata arises in the world and presents the teaching that, yes, there are results to one's actions. And so therefore, I teach you the precepts that it's beneficial not to take the life of living creatures. It's beneficial not to take that which is not given. It's beneficial to refrain from sexual misconduct. It's beneficial to not tell lies, to tell the truth. And the student reflects, well, actually, I have taken life. And I have stolen things, and I have committed sexual misconduct, and I have told lies. And that's not good. That's caused harm. And then he further reflects. I won't be able to undo that. The deed is done. I can't change the fact that I committed those mistakes, breaking those precepts. And then upon recognition of that, the person makes the resolve. I won't do that anymore. I'm going to make a determination not to take the life of any living creature anymore or all the other precepts that I've broken. I'll make that strong determination. And when that determination is made, when that resolve is very solid, and the person follows through on that, then that is, in the Buddha's words in this teaching, that is the transcendence of that offense, of that state of mind. And furthermore, the student, the disciple, tries to develop some very beautiful boundless states of mind and makes that determination that he will pervade one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, the fourth quarter, above, below, around, and everywhere, to all as to himself. And he will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. And he further develops a mind imbued with compassion, with altruistic joy, with equanimity, the four Brahmaviharas, the four divine abidings, in a large, extensive, expansive, unlimited mind. And as he is able to develop those states of mind, then any effect from past actions, from past karma, will not be felt, particularly if he develops them to the extent of fully experiencing those Brahmaviharas, those expansive states of mind, and is reborn into the Brahma worlds, then the effects of past actions won't be able to meet up with him. There is such an expansive abiding with those beautiful states of mind that the effects of those past actions can't manifest in that kind of environment. So, very contrary to the other teachers who were talking about a very deterministic way of seeing karma, this shows that the effects of karma can be ameliorated. Through actually recognizing the difficult mind states, the obstructive mind states that one has had, the mistakes one's made, the regrets over it that one has had, and then the resolution to move on from that and to develop these beautiful states of mind. So there's hope. Because we've all done things that we regret. And when I heard that teaching myself and reflected on it, I felt a great sense of relief that it's not, I don't have to live with these mind states and these regrets forever. And that sense of guilt and self-punishment that we kind of keep inflicting on each other is really that same energy that condemns us, in a sense, to a hell realm, you know, regardless of whether we believe in rebirth or not, what happens after this, the particular lifetime. Oftentimes we commit ourselves to experiencing a hellish state of mind through this constant regurgitation of past crimes that we have done, past unskillful actions, and that we don't need to do that. We need to acknowledge the mistakes we've made and realize that we can't undo them, but we can resolve to do better and to let those old habits die away. And then we can experience some really beautiful states of mind. And in some other teachings, the Buddha also talks about the fact that even if we can't fully develop those Brahmaviharas to be a state of long-term abiding in the Brahma realm, even if they're not fully developed, the more we can develop them, the less we will experience those results of past karmic actions. We won't be able to change the fact that we will experience something, but if we develop our minds around kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity, particularly equanimity, to the extent that we're able to do that, the effects of our past actions will be somewhat muted. And he gives a simile of like a glass of water, having a glass of water, a small glass of water, in which you put a spoon of salt and you mix it up and then you taste the water. And for sure, you'll taste that salt. It will be very noticeable. As opposed to taking that same spoon of salt and tossing it into a large body of water, like a lake, or in his description, the river Ganges, and letting it dissolve and disperse, and then taking a taste of that water and not being able to really sense much of a taste of salt at all, maybe even just a hint, but maybe nothing. And that having that simile of the mind, if the mind is small and narrow and constricted and troubled and filled with anxiety and fear and confusion and irritation, you know, a very narrow, small state of mind, then the effects of kama will be very noticeable, very much felt, as opposed to that more expansive state of mind that's open, free, kind, allowing, receptive, then we have a much more stable and firm sense of goodness. And when we do experience the result of something, even if it's just the memory coming back up over and again, we can hold it in a very different way, and it doesn't have that same effect. And of course, if we go beyond even those exalted states of mind to a true liberation of mind, a true noble liberation, then we set the stage for the ending of the experience of kama when this life is over, and we transcend the whole realm of rebirth altogether. So our actions do make a difference in ameliorating that the effect of past actions. And there's a way to do it that he has set out very clearly. Something that I've also found very useful to reflect on is just the idea of redemption and the possibility of that. And the Buddha offers definitely examples of that in the teachings. The one that most people are familiar with is Angulimala, the serial killer, who the Buddha recognized had a potential for awakening and was able to stop him after he had killed so many people, and was able to prevent him from, at least in the story as it goes, he was about to kill his 1,000th victim, and the Buddha was able to stop him and get him to see that what he was doing was very harmful to himself, not to mention the others. And that, with some time and with some training, Angulimala was able to transcend his history and actually became one of the enlightened arahants. He still experienced some of the effects, the karmic effects of his deeds, but that was, he had done his work with the Buddha's teaching, and he was destined on his death to never be reborn again. He was fully liberated. And so I think that's always a useful thing if regrets come up, is to say, well, how many people have I killed? And probably most of us can hopefully say none, but even if we have, we probably haven't gotten up to 999. If Angulimala can do it, so can I. And also just realizing that power to be able to change, no matter what our conditioning is. There was a story that I read about a couple of years ago and talked a bit about at a couple of Thanksgiving retreats ago, about the same time. And it was a pretty fraught time a couple of years ago in November. People were feeling, the retreat happened over Thanksgiving, and just a couple of weeks before had been the elections 2 years ago, and there was a lot of people who were going through a lot of anxiety and panic almost after that election. It seemed to be a really good time to tell this story that I had just come across. And it was a very potent story for me in particular, because it was relating events that were happening in Durham, North Carolina, which is where I grew up and went to elementary, junior high, and high school, and also college later on. But it was a time during the desegregation of the public schools in the South, and Durham was a bit behind in the implementation of that, but it was coming into effect just as I was coming into high school. So finally the court orders were taking place, and the desegregation of the schools in the city of Durham was happening as I was entering the 10th grade. This was in the around 1970 or so, 70-71. And it was a very potent time in racial history, particularly in that town. Durham was a pretty unique kind of a town in some ways, and not so unique in other ways. It had the usual segregated neighborhoods, and even within the white population, there was a division of, in East Durham, there were was a population of blue-collar and lower socioeconomic groupings of white people in East Durham, and then in West and Southwest Durham was a population of white people that were more middle class and upper middle class, and I was living in Southwest Durham, which was sort of the university, Duke University section of it. So my father was on the faculty there, so there was this enclave of upper middle class, but fairly liberal white people that was the community that I grew up in. There was also another couple of areas of town where there was a bit more of the elite, very wealthy business people, white business people in that town. And then there was a couple of different black sections of town too, one being very poor and very underserved area of town in south and eastern parts of the city. And the thing that was unusual about Durham was that there was actually a very substantial black middle class as well, and even upper middle class to some extent, in part of the town, in part of the eastern part of the town. So it was quite a wide variety of socioeconomic and racial groupings, but all as was usual in the South, and actually in most of the country, the neighborhood divisions were pretty big. So the integration of the schools, the desegregation, was a pretty big deal. And there were only two high schools, and one was the former white high school, and one was the former black high school, each in their respective parts of town. And as I was entering the 10th grade, my section of the city was being bused to the former black high school. And I ended up attending high school in that school, and it ended up being because of the white flight to the suburbs, which some of you may have heard about, as a result of the desegregation, a lot of the whites within the city limits fled to the suburbs so that they wouldn't have to do that, so that the rest of us ended up going to a different part of town, being bused across the town to help keep the ratios as close to 50-50 as they could. But as it ended up, because of that white flight, I ended up going to the high school, and it was ended up being 25% white and 75% black. And as all this was evolving, and before it actually happened, some farsighted people within the city planning decided that the best way to reduce the tension and try and prevent any kind of violence with the desegregation of the schools was to try and have some seminars and prepare people who were going to be involved, prepare them for what might things might be like, and to try and get things out onto the table to see if we could reduce the fears and the frustrations and the questions. And it ended up being that the there were two moderators that were to be chosen, and again, with a fair amount of bravery and foresight, rather than, say, choosing the most elite or educated members of the communities, the commissioners that were setting this panel up decided that they wanted to try and have moderators who were from the areas of town that where there might be the most volatility, as a way of just looking honestly at what the potential might be. So they ended up asking and recruiting a very, very strong community activist from the black community, a woman named Ann Atwater, who was known to be quite outspoken and quite strong in her pursuit of equality for the black population of town, and to really up the ante, their selection for the white moderator was a man named C.P. Ellis, who was from East Durham and was the actual head of the Ku Klux Klan of Durham. So it was a really powerful combination, and the fact that they both actually agreed to be part of that was very unusual as well. I think that both of them had children who were in the public schools, and particularly as it is related, particularly for C.P. Ellis, that he realized at some level that this was going to happen, and if he wanted it, his children to be able to benefit from being in the schools, he was going to have to be part of this process. So the two of them were appointed the co-chairs of this this committee to do seminars to prepare for the desegregation of the schools. And there was a lot of contention, a lot of difficulty, as you might imagine, from a community black activist meeting up and trying to coordinate with the head of the KKK, a pretty potent mixture of energies, and with a huge amount of conflict in the beginning. But they foraged on and did the best they could, and eventually were able to get some of the seminars going. Not without a lot of contention, though. And as the evenings went on, and concerns were voiced and issues were discussed, tempers flared and disagreements opened up, but they kept on plugging on. And it came to a point where one evening, apparently after everyone had left and dispersed for the evening, Anne Atwater and C.P. Ellis were left together by themselves. And as the story goes, somehow a discussion started, and Anne Atwater was talking about the gravity of her situation, the situation that her family was in, the poverty that they experienced, the disadvantage they had, just the difficulty that she had sometimes even trying to get food on the table, having enough money to feed her family, not to mention to have some sort of sense of normalcy of life, and was just trying to express that and have him understand what it was that was her experience and their experience in that community. And as he was listening, he also started to reflect, because he was from a very poor background himself. He was a blue-collar worker. He didn't earn much money. And his children were suffering in the same way that hers were. And as he was listening to her, maybe for the first time really deeply, he realized that they were exactly the same, that all of the sense of underprivilege that he felt and that drove him to look for his own stability and community within the KKK. That was his way of finding some sense of belonging as an underprivileged person himself, as undervalued in his community, in his racial community, that he realized that their struggles were exactly the same. And in that moment, as the story goes, he had this breakthrough, and this emotional breakdown, if you will, and just realized that all of that he had been holding as his racial prejudice was unfounded, his experience was exactly the same as hers. And in that moment, realized that he just couldn't live that life anymore, couldn't live in that sense of racial prejudice anymore, and broke down. And that was a very strong turning point for both of them in their relationship. And as the story unfolds further, the commission ended, the schools integrated, and they went on with their respective lives. And he ended up leaving the KKK, resigning. He just couldn't do it anymore. He ended up actually becoming a community activist in his own right and started working for the labor unions in town to try and bring benefit to the underpaid workers in the mills that he was working in. Durham was a big mill town and also a tobacco town with a lot of underpaid workers. So he was involved in helping to form the labor unions that helped bring them up, bring the standard of living up, realizing that all of his concerns were based on a lack of privilege because of class, not because of race, racial issues. But this kind of redemption and this kind of reconciliation amongst people from incredibly different backgrounds, I just found that such a moving story, and it was so pertinent to me because of my position as a student in high school while all this was going on. I found that so moving, and a reflection for me that redemption, you know, reconciliation is possible. So that no matter what my conditioning is, what your conditioning is, we have that potential for renewal. So there's teachings on reconciliation and forgiveness as well. Reconciliation when we've had regrets, when we've transgressed our precepts, when we've broken our precepts. In the monastic tradition, we have a regular routine of bringing up every 2 weeks any offenses that we've had to our rules of training. Part of that process is recognizing that we've made a mistake and then mentioning it to another monk before we chant the rules of discipline for that every 2 weeks. And making that resolution to do better, to not break those precepts again as part of the process of the confession. So we've institutionalized that into our life at the monastery and with our vows of that we've taken as monks here. But the process can be the same for the lay community as well, to have some sort of sense of recognition and resolve to do better. And it can often be applied also to interactions we've had with people. If we've had difficult interactions, difficult times, regrets about what we've said, or anger maybe about what other people have said to us, and we're holding on to these things, then it is possible, given the right set of circumstances, to try and reconcile that and move on, let go. Sometimes it's not easy because people who want to reconcile have to come together and admit that there was a wrongdoing of some sort. The person who did something wrong has to actually be brave enough to say, I made a mistake. And that's not always so easy. Have to recognize that we actually did something and that it was an offense against our precepts or was something that was harmful. And have the other person receive that. And to really come to true reconciliation so that the stage is set for resolution and moving on, one has to engage with the other in examining the set of values that you might hold in common, that we might hold in common, to see if we can identify what set of values was broken in that transgression or in that disagreement, that argument, that harshness, breaking of precepts, whatever the case may be. Looking back to and examining, well, what do we hold as a common set of values that we can agree on and say, okay, well, this violated that set of values and resolve not to do that again, because we both believe in harmony, we both believe in goodness, we both believe in honesty, whatever values it is that was violated at that time, to really recognize those and verbalize those, bring them to consciousness. And then to say, okay, from now on, let's both try to hold up to this. You know, we all make mistakes. It's time to forgive. And based on our common understanding of what we both value, we'll go on from here. And the immense amount of healing that can happen when two people can do that with each other. It's a full kind of reconciliation. Sometimes that's not possible either. Sometimes we have regrets for things that we said, the person's no longer around, or things that we've done that can't be corrected. The deed is done, and the potential for reconciliation isn't there, or the other person doesn't want to reconcile, they don't want to talk, they may not be ready to engage and reconcile the differences. And when that's the case, we do still have the ability to forgive. We have the ability to forgive others, even if they're not willing to admit their mistakes. We have the ability to forgive ourselves, even if we can't reconcile with the person that we've done wrong to. We can look back, we can examine our behavior, our actions. And with that sense of, yeah, I blew it, and I can't undo that, and I can't reconcile it now because the other person's not there, either physically or psychologically. They're not there to reconcile with, but I can vow to go forth and to never do that kind of thing again, and to work on letting go, so that we don't keep on creating a hell realm for ourselves. True forgiveness is a real gift to ourselves. So there's different ways that we can help ourselves come to this kind of reconciliation. And it's really, a lot of it is developing that sense of what's skillful, what's unskillful, and feeling confident in that, and bringing that into our lives, the recognition of what's kusala, what's akusala, wholesome and unwholesome, and starting to let those be our guidelines in how we live our lives. Those are the values that I was talking about when we were trying to reconcile. We have to start to understand and live from the values of what's wholesome and what's and knowing what's unwholesome and avoiding those. So encouraging, developing the wholesome states of mind and really starting to live by them, and recognizing the unwholesome states of mind that are habits that get us into these difficulties that cause us to break precepts or to get into conflict with others. And this is the long-term strategy for preventing the regrets from arising and for dealing with them through recognition as we remember them. And to start to really establish a sense of value and appreciation for the wholesome mind states, the fact that we all have the potential to develop the states like generosity and kindness and moral virtue, patience, wisdom, kindness, determination, energy, all of the what we can call the perfections, the 10 perfections that the Buddha talks about, and that these are within our capacity to develop and establish as the basis for our life. And we can start to let go of the unwholesome ones, all the results from being, from greed, hatred, delusion, the irritations, the harsh words, the anger that we express, the different states of mind that lead us into difficulty and conflict. We recognize those and start to let them go, and through precepts and other practices, not expressing them, not giving them power through expression, learning to restrain ourselves. The precepts are are protectors to help us restrain from creating unwholesome kamma, from acting with akusala intention. So this is the long-term strategy as well as the short-term strategy in letting go of past regrets, is developing an understanding around what's wholesome and unwholesome. This is also, in the teachings, one of the great dispellers of the hindrance of doubt. If we have doubts about the teachings, doubts about our practice, how it's working for us, whether we're actually really progressing or not, is to really reflect on wholesome, unwholesome action, and to see if we really understand those. And if we really do, if we really know what's wholesome to develop and what's unwholesome that needs to be abandoned, then we'll have that sense of clarity that even if we haven't perfected those wholesome traits or abandoned all of the unwholesome ones, that we know what our moral compass is, what our compass for developing the practice is. And that gives a sense of stability. We have a clear measure. So even if we haven't gotten there yet, we know when we get off the track, we see it more quickly, and we develop the wholesome ones more consistently. And that helps to give a sense of security in our approach. So this real deep understanding of kusala, akusala, will help dispel a sense of doubt in our practice. Also, just trying to give ourselves a sense of inspiration to get us through, to help help us resolve our troubling times when we're looking back. And sometimes we can get really lost in that sense of despair of like, oh God, I've made so many mistakes, I've done so many harmful things, and that we can get lost in that, or just in the lack of what we perceive as the lack of progress in our practice over the past year. Maybe it doesn't seem like we've really gotten anywhere. And sometimes when we get kind of stewing in that situation, particularly if we've been practicing a long time, is to go back and revisit the initial inspiration that got us looking at the Dhamma in the first place, to refresh that sense of interest and inspiration in the teachings. Whether we came into the practice through some recognition of dukkha, suffering in our lives, experiencing difficult times, and to the point that propelled us to the spiritual search, or whether we were inspired by somebody who was a beautiful being or who displayed characteristics through this practice that we admired and were attracted to, inspired by someone with a lot of loving kindness or caring or wisdom that was able to guide us into the spiritual search. So actively bringing those things up for recollection, what was our initial inspiration? Can we move back to that fresh state of mind that started us and kicked us into the path? And sometimes that can be very uplifting and energizing and help get us over a hump. Or just remembering the awesomeness of the teachings, the incredible gift that the Buddha has given to us through his realization and subsequent teaching, the dispensation that's lasted so long, and the purity and clarity and precision of the teachings, a very, very clearly demarcated path that leads to the full ending of suffering. Just how incredible that is, how lucky we are to have found that, and the blessing of being in a group of like-minded people who are pursuing it, who all have the same history of difficulties and the wish to be free, that we're here to support each other with that. Just remembering those can provide that sense of inspiration. So, end of the year, looking back, trying to let go of any lingering regrets, past issues that we feel bad about, seeing if there's ways that we can understand them and hold them in a way that's not punishing ourselves over and over again, but ways of internally reconciling them. And then if possible, if it involves other people, externally reconciling them as well through skillful interaction, skillful discourse, so that we can start to wipe the slate a bit cleaner and not suffer under the weight of guilt, regret, remorse that takes us into dark realms. And not to disparage ourselves, but to encourage ourselves for being here, just being here, whether we're here as residents, trying to make a go of the training, or people who are long-term supporters coming to tap in on a regular basis, or even first-time visitors who are just stumbling across the monastery, that just really recognizing that something good's happening and that we've had the good fortune to find our way here, to be part of it, and to slowly look towards the potential that we all have for peace of mind and for eventually, hopefully, a freedom that is complete and irreversible. So just a few thoughts to keep us going through into the new year, and I'll leave it there for tonight's reflection. New Year's Eve, we have the opportunity to keep practicing together, sitting meditation, walking meditation as you see fit. Just encourage people to come and go quietly if you're coming and going into the hall. And then we'll gather, maybe start gathering around 11:30, and we'll probably start doing our paritta chanting, maybe about 11:40 or so, about 20 minutes worth, so that we enter 12 midnight, the new year, on a auspicious note with the auspicious chanting. So enjoy the rest of the evening and see you at 11:30.